Welcome to Trillo Talk. This is a podcast dedicated to topics that we think are important to the profession of medical writing. And our goal is to bring topical issues to the forefront and hopefully spark conversations in the wider domain about these issues. I'm Julia Fianich-Klaproth, Senior Partner at Trilogy Writing and Consulting, and I'm here today with Jonathan McKinnon, who is Associate Medical Writing Services Director at Parexel International. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Julia. Thanks for having me.
So Jonathan and I are both, well, I guess you could say activists of a sort, trying to raise awareness about the importance of good study design and well-written protocols. And that's the topic we're going to explore today. So, Jonathan, you have a regular newsletter on LinkedIn called Protocol Development, right?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. And it's dedicated to informing the community about news, regulatory updates, articles published, all on the topic of clinical study protocols and study design. And I know I find that incredibly valuable resource. And I was wondering, what was the driver for you to start this newsletter?
Well, I mean, it was kind of born out of something that I was doing already. So as one of the kind of protocol subject matter experts within the medical writing group, spend some time looking at different articles, looking at, the progress, how things are changing, challenges that we're facing. And, with COVID, there was a whole kind of period of accelerated change where all of a sudden things were being done that previously weren't, typical or part of the kind of everyday kind of protocol. So, as part of this kind of looking at this kind of work, I thought, if I'm already doing this, then it would be great to share this with everyone else, because as we all know, it's very difficult to be able to keep on top of things with so much information being generated on a daily basis and alongside that the work itself. So that was really the kind of starting point. And then since then, I think we're coming up to the 20th kind of issue, so that's kind of every fortnight just a summary of all of the different topics. And it's been a great way to kind of draw attention to some of the, more kind of key highlights and then also provide more information around certain topics that people might find interesting when they're looking at protocol development.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a huge amount of information. Honestly, until the newsletter, you started doing the newsletter, I don't think I was aware how much was coming out at such regular intervals. I mean, like you said, it comes out every 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks you seem to find another 20 articles. Just every time I'm like, oh my goodness, there's that much again. It sometimes it almost feels overwhelming how much information is coming out, but also incredibly helpful to have it all in one place where you can go and see, okay, are there any topics that are specifically relevant to what I'm doing right now or something like that. So thank you.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is information that people can kind of use in their day to day. Other pieces are kind of just more for kind of, thinking around the topic. A lot of protocol development really is focused around knowing what resources are available and how to implement those. Because, for a lot of study teams, when they're coming to develop a protocol, people have experience, sure, and, they're applying that experience to, within their certain kind of responsibility. For example, the medic is obviously providing the kind of medical input, biostatistician, statistics, et cetera. But at the same time, things are kind of constantly evolving. The challenges that they're facing now might be, unique challenges that they've never faced before. And, one of the questions is, how are we supposed to deal with that? How do we go about doing that? I mean, for example, Estimans, for the last couple of years, this has been a kind of ongoing topic on how to properly implement estimands, how to describe them in protocols. And a lot of, teams struggle with this because biostats, the biostatistician needs support. They can't determine what intercurrent events are needed. They need that support it's multidisciplinary. And, having, awareness of what kind of information is out there, And this particular example, I'm kind of thinking of the recent kind of those recent publication about how to write SD demands into protocols. Having that resource available means that you can kind of take it off the shelf and say, okay, here is the article that describes this. Here is what we can do to get that discussion going and then get everyone on that same track, because that's where you need to, you know, get people kind of moving in the same direction at the same velocity.
Yeah. I totally agree. I'm amazed at how estimates is a great example. It's a topic that for many people is still a fringe topic. Yeah. Like, people are out there not developing their protocols and they're not even talking about it. And like you said, it's one thing to go in as a medical writer to a team and say, well, you know, we need to think about estimands. But then if you don't have something to lean into, the team kind of looks at you, you know, like a deer caught in the headlights, blinks a couple times, and they're waiting for you to tell them what to do. But with these resources, you can actually put something on the table. Like you said, get the discussion going. And they understand it's not just you finding some rare gem somewhere. This is real. This is happening. And there's a lot of people talking about it and saying how we should be implementing it. And obviously, the better informed people are about the regulations and guidelines and whatever, and how to apply them, the more likely the protocols we prepare are actually going to meet those regulatory needs, right? Mm-hmm. And do what they're intended for. But I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm up on this soapbox about protocols is because I really think it's one of the unsung heroes. So many people are looking in the industry for ways to increase efficiencies and save time. And they're trying all kinds of technologies and things, and all those things are great. But it seems to me like there's this really simple fix, simple in quotations, obviously, but, you know, simple fix that if we could just get people writing protocols that do a better job of explaining what they're about, more consistently presenting the information, helping people find things in them, that all the downstream effects would be enormous. You know, if you have a study that could run well without amendments and all the problems that come up with because protocols are poorly communicated, think of how much time we could save there. But then also the knock-on effects to writing your clinical study reports, and then beyond that, writing your dossiers. Like, there's so much room for improvement just by fixing the starting point, because this is the highest upstream document.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good point. I mean, you know, if we work, you know, to deliver a more kind of accurate and a more kind of comprehensive kind of foundational element like the protocol, then, you know, everything else that you build on top is more robust. And, you know, I think that, you know, one of the exciting things about the E8R1 is, you know, around these kind of two pillars of the, you know, quality by design and patient centricity, and how to kind of bring those together. Because, you know, it's in isolation, you can look at a single thing and say, okay, you know, we need to work on this, you know, for example, DCT, decentralized clinical trial components. You know, say, okay, I want to make some, I want to add some DCT components to my study in order to have better, you know, patient centricity, you know, better recruitment, etc. You apply that, that's a single kind of component. But then, you know, on the other hand, you might also be looking at, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, that's another area that you might want to consider in a different way. You know, you've got also got patient engagement. So all of these kind of things are feeding into that one specific document.
Yes.
And with E8R1, with quality by design, you know, the proponents are really, the foundation is really to focus on what is critical to the quality of that study, and bringing it all down to that, saying, okay, this is what's critical, this is what we are building our study around. You can have everything else in there as you need it, but you don't focus your efforts on building your study around that, you know, the non-critical to quality parts.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of the reason that that doesn't happen often, is what I mean, is the industry hires people, specialists in, who bring academic knowledge, right? You hire some doctors, and they might even have experience running studies, but they're they're generally thinking about it from an academic perspective. And they're thinking about what papers they're eventually going to write about this. But they're not thinking about it from the context of how to get regulatory approval for a drug. And ultimately, the clinical studies that we're writing in the regulatory sphere are there for that purpose, and they need to focus on it. And that's exactly the challenge, right? And helping these people as they come into the industry out of a more academic sphere to see what we're trying to do and what regulations there are that need to be followed in order to achieve that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that kind of perspective is still quite prevalent. You know, you have a lot of people that are looking at this study and saying, okay, you know, we're going to make this investment. We're going to make this, you know, kind of time investment. It's got, you know, financial repercussions. We want to extract the most amount of value out of that, which is perfectly reasonable. But if you lose sight of what is key to the study, then you can start adding on all of these extra nice to haves. Ultimately, this is just adding on. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's adding on to the participants, you know, the time spent on site or time spent at home, you know, collecting information, filling in diaries, et cetera, you know, you keep adding all this information to a certain point that might add, that might contribute to the value of the study. But after that, you risk people saying, okay, you know, I don't want to participate in this study because you're asking me to do too much. And the...
Absolutely.
No, I can't fit this in. You know, if I have to, you know, get up on my, you know, on a Tuesday, and then I have to fill in, you know, an hour's worth of information.
Forms,
you
know, whatever. Yeah.
You've got to start your day an hour later. So you need to make sure that you're getting up and doing that. And over time, you know, that kind of constant accrual of information required, it just, you know, it's a burden to the individual.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And I mean, what you said about, okay, it's fair enough that they're trying to get as much as they can out of a study. However, we also know there are tough studies that have analyzed the effect of having more and more complex study designs and more things that you're trying to do. And they show definitively that those studies have far more study amendments. They cost more, they take longer, you know. So yes, maybe you... In an ideal world, you're thinking, I'm going to get more out of this study. But in the end, if what you get is really poor quality data and poor mm-hmm. compliance from your patients, and the things take way longer than you intended, then have you really won? You haven't. You've lost out. And I think the industry needs to find a way of balancing getting the biggest bang for your buck, mm-hmm. but also getting some bang at all, right? You need to have a study that gives you good quality, solid data to answer your key regulatory questions, and they need to be focusing on those things.
Yeah, there was a paper that I think the one that you're referring to was from Smith et al. Earlier this year, and it was kind of born out of Kenneth Getz's Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development. And yeah, this study specifically looked at, I think it was something like 190 protocols across different organizations, and they looked at the operational output of that. And yeah, what they found was that, you know, there is a trade-off. If, you know, you increase the complexity, the performance decreases. And it is something to bear in mind. You know, if you want to, you know, your ambition might be there to do a really interesting and complex study, but on a kind of practical level, you know, the operationalization of a study design, you know, you need to balance that. Okay, this is really interesting and this is really, you know, helpful information versus what will we actually get? You know, there's interviews with people that work in kind of recruitment and retention, and they, you know, they say that, you know, participants, you know, they do get overburdened, they do miss things, but also, you know, other people that work in the you know, in the study, you know, you've got people that need to pick up a protocol, flip through it and say, okay, I know, you know, I've got a participant coming in and it's, I don't know, visit 10. We need to know what we're doing. We need to know when we're doing it and how we're going to do it. And if you have a protocol that's like 300 pages, then, you know, exactly. How are you going to pick that up and just refresh yourself? You know, you can't read Lord of the Rings in like, you know, 10 minutes. You have to spend time doing it.
They're often really poorly constructed as a cookbook, let's call it that, right? Mm-hmm. Which is ultimately what it is. You know, like you said, you want to cook a cake, you want to be able to pick it up and first of all, see really quickly and easily, what are my ingredients? And then you want to be able to go to the section that says, okay, now what do I do with these ingredients? And I'm amazed from, if I come from the angle of writing a dossier, one of the first things I try and understand for each new dossier is, what was the dosing regimen? What's the recommended dosing regimen that we're going to be putting out there in our label, right? And I need to go and find the evidence for that. And I need to provide the rationalization for that. Do you know how many programs I go back to the protocols and they don't tell you that information? Not only do they not give you a rationalization for it, I struggle to even find in a clear, concise way what the dose was, what the prescribed dose was in that study. It's often distributed over like three different sections. They'll sort of say the amount you need in one, and then they'll say the regimen that you need in another section. And every time I think, imagine if a cookbook was written like that. You know, we kind of have some of the ingredients over here and some of the ingredients over here and never in exactly the same place between recipes, you know, just to keep you on your toes. And I think, come on, you guys, certainly as an industry, we should be able to streamline the way we're putting these protocols together. There should be a clear place where all the information for dosing always is, no matter which company, no matter what indication. Like, you shouldn't have to think about that. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I love the Trendcelerate idea, because let's all get off our hobby horses and forget about personal preferences and find a way to do something that's really standardized across the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a Trendcelerate super fan, really. You know, their protocol template, I mean, except for this year, you know, there's an annual release. It's, you know, it's great that they are continuing to maintain that. And I think that, you know, it really helps, you know, if we're all reading from the same kind of structure, then it really helps to navigate between protocols as well, you know, to be able to say, okay, you know, regardless of the organization that owns it, you know, it all follows the same kind of template. So you can, you know, where, you know, okay, I'm going to look at eligibility criteria. Okay, it's going to be section 5. That's fine. You know, you straight away, you know how that is. And exactly. You know, on the occasion that I come across templates that are not aligned with Trendcelerate, it's always takes a bit of time to be able to kind of reorientate yourself. So I, you know, I sympathize for, you know, sites and anyone else that has to use protocols on a daily basis if they, you know, if they have to adapt these different structures.
Yeah. You want to speed things up? Give people things the same way every time, not only on the sites, but also reviewers at agencies. Mm-hmm. You know, when they finally get to the point where they're looking at all the different things, and it's different every single time. So they have to sort of wrap their brain around it every single time. You could speed up review if we just used a standardized way of presenting the information.
Yeah, I think it's changing. I think that there's, you know, more and more on a kind of daily basis, there's more recognition that standardization is the way forward.
I agree.
Even with the draft M11 guidance on C#, which is the kind of electronic protocols, the structure is very similar to Trendcelerate, and I think over time, you know, we're going to see just, you know, a unified structure that people are going to be using. And you know, some academic groups are also, you know, not aligning as such, but also kind of recognizing that these standards exist. There was the recent publication around enhancing protocol templates for diversity, equity, and inclusion, and, you know, they used the Trendcelerate template as a just a template in order to build their work on this, so that it was, you know, freely available to all. You understood, you know, you could see what sections were what, you could go through and you could see it. And I think this is, you know, really, you know, over the last 10 years, this has been a huge change over that time.
It has. Yeah. The industry is just such a big tanker, right? You know, the trying to get it to turn around process is so incredibly slow. But I agree with you. there's definitely hope on the horizon. I know a couple of our clients are rolling out next year new Transcelerate-based templates. Of course, they all have to take a slightly different turn on it, but that's okay. If, you know, if we get closer to standardization, that's better. And so, yeah, finally, more and more bigger companies are starting to really actually implement the Transcelerate idea and the standardization. And I guess ultimately that would be a great first step, just having a standardized way of presenting all this information.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in, you know, within master protocols, you know, that it's, you know, a perfect case study of where standardization is still missing, and how, you know, when you have to set up a master protocol study protocol, you know, you have to kind of work on that structure as one of the foundational elements. And it's challenging because every study is different and every study is approaching it in a different way. And with the diversity of master protocols, you can't have a kind of single unified structure, but having something that people can use as a basis is already a huge step forward. And EU Pearl is working towards that. And I think early next year, they're going to be releasing a template for platform studies. So platform studies being the, you know, multiple different interventions, multiple participant groups, typically, you know, new products are added at a later time point. And these studies are complicated, and these studies can run into, you know, several hundred pages.
Yeah. Well, those are the sort of motherships of studies, right?
Yeah. But at the moment, you know, there's no template. So, you know, each group has to kind of figure out what would be the best structure. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to when that template comes out, because although they're releasing it, their kind of work packages are wrapping up, I think, later on in the year. And after that, it looks, you know, it looks like Transcelerate will be picking that up and maintaining that moving forward. So, you know, I think that, you know, this would be something as well that really would help writers, especially, you know, any writer that's worked on a master protocol can probably recognize the challenges when it comes to structuring these studies. Just because, you know, teams come in and they say, okay, well, you know, we're going to do this type of study. If you don't build the structure right first time, then you have to kind of rework it mid protocol. There's a lot of rework. It doesn't help the quality of the document. So, you know, it's good to kind of, you know, sequentially start off foundational elements, build it up from there.
Absolutely. Well, Jonathan, I know that you and I could talk about this forever, and I've got lots of other things I'd like to pick your brain on, but I think I'll save those for another podcast.
Okay.
So it was a pleasure talking with you today, and I look forward to our future sessions.
Likewise.
Great. So just a note to our listeners, Jonathan and I are in the process of curating a special supplement that focuses on the reasons the industry should be spending more time on making sure that they get clinical study protocols right. It's going to be a collection of articles looking at various angles of the topic, and it should go to press at the end of January. So keep your eye out for it. We're hoping the articles might provide some good arguments and ideas for our writers everywhere who are championing the cause in their companies and with their teams. So watch for announcements of it on LinkedIn in probably early February is what I'm guessing. Okay. Take care, Jonathan.
All right. Thank you.
So thank you for listening to Trilla Talk today. If you enjoyed it, please come back and listen to us again. If you have feedback on this or any of our sessions, we would love to hear it. In addition, if you have ideas for future topics that you'd like us to cover, particularly something you think the community should be talking about, let us know. We would like this to be an ongoing conversation with medical writers at large, and you can send us comments on our Twitter feed or on our LinkedIn page. Just a reminder, you can find all our episodes of the Trilla Talk podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and trilogywriting.com/Trillotalk. Have a good rest of your day.